Good morning, everybody, and good afternoon, good evening. It's another beautiful day down here in Texas, believe it or not. We wish our friends well on the other part of the Gulf Coast that's obviously got the brunt of Hurricane Ida. We got the brunt of Hurricane Ike last year, so we're grateful that it passed us over. In any event, I'm a musician. I think I've mentioned this on several occasions. And what you heard leading in is a little bit of steel drums. And, you know, this is an instrument that really only came about down in Trinidad in the mid-1940s. So it's probably one of the most modern-day instruments out there. So there are not a whole lot of us in this world that play steel drums. But I do, and I love it because of the vibration of the sounds that it tends to make. And, you know, music is really an international, a universal language. We all vibrate, believe it or not, from spirit. And music is really, you know, comes from us and from spirit and from instruments that we create. And, you know, one of the things that I thought would be an interesting subject is, you know, nothing better on where genealogy and spirit connect is to have where music and ancestry meet. And my guest today, in fact, is a person that is an expert on music and ancestry. And so we're going to have a very interesting conversation, especially about music and what it means and what it meant to our ancestors and what it means to us and our legacies that we leave to our children. So I want to welcome Jean Wilcox-Hibben, and she is a PhD, believe it or not, in speech communications, and has worked as a professor for over 13 years and left the academic world to pursue her passion in genealogy and family history, as did I. But she is board certified. She is a volunteer at the Corona California Family History Center and trains family history consultants, a national speaker with over 40 years of public speaking and performing experience. And her main interest is in melding historical events with the music that illustrates, as she has on her website, really the life and times of our ancestors. So, Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You know, we're both musicians, and, you know, one of the things that I know is that when I was growing up, my interest in music was not as keen as it is in my later years. I don't know why that is. I guess maybe because some of us are pushed into it when we really in a way that doesn't really come from the spirit and from the soul. So
interesting thought, yeah.
You know, now it's my life, and you know, I was doing a lot of reading, and you know, Albert Einstein claims that his whole concept and theory on relativity really came from his love of music and his practicing music, and as he actually stood there playing his violin, you know, the whole theory of relativity came through him, through his intuition, and, you know, is something of which the whole world now is based on. Pretty interesting thought, isn't it?
Yeah, that is quite interesting. My father worked with Einstein for a very
really?
Short period of time. Yeah. My father played flute in the Princeton Orchestra, where he was working with Einstein at the Institute for Advanced Study. And I had forgotten that little detail about Einstein's connection of music to the real world. And that's kind of an interesting thought. Now I have to go back and take a look at some of my father's notes.
Well, you know, I mean, really it is. I mean, music really is vibrational. I mean, if you think of life as you know, one vibration, and we create music with vibration. We live or try to live lives that are harmonious. And, you know, here we have all these harmonies. And, I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than listening to, you know, harmonious instruments that are playing, you know, the same music but in harmony with each other. And, it's just a beautiful, uplifting, spiritual, and creative thing. And it's just, you know, a shame that some of us, you know, really had to wait to our later years to kind of embrace music as to what it really is.
You so, have to have the time to do that.
Well, that's true.
Also, I mean, people look at music as not necessary in the big scope of survival from one day to the next, and so therefore the appreciation of music has to be when we have the time to stop work long enough to appreciate it. And that's sad, because I think that we could all work and be more efficient in whatever it is we choose to do if we embrace music as well, because it has a tendency to relax us. It also can have a tendency to make us very nervous, depending on what the music is. But I believe it was Aristotle who identified the planets as all having a musical connection. And so it certainly is all around us all the time.
It really is. And, you know, what our topic of conversation is on the, you know, how our instruments and music was used and how, you know, during the history of our ancestors. And, you know, there are a couple of things that I think that you mentioned in your website and in your blogs that are, you know, very well represented about how we can, you know, even determine the type of instruments that our ancestors may have played during their lifetimes.
Oh, yeah. And there are various ways of finding that out. Of course, a lot of people are very fortunate and have the instruments their ancestors played. They actually get passed down to them. But there are other ways. So you can find out through wills and tax records and that sort of thing. And certainly personal diaries and what have you.
So, you know, going back, for example, let's just say that I have ancestors from Lithuania and Russia. What would be the primary instrument, do you think, that my ancestors might have played?
Well, the lute instruments, balalaika, mandolin, probably, I would say, violin, fiddle.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they wouldn't call it fiddle, they would call it violin over there. the style of music as to what we want to call it. I don't know what horns they had, but I know there were some, because there are certain ceremonial horns that are used in, for instance, Christmas celebrations. And whether or not they were actually played as musical instruments as well, I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
Yeah.
And there would be percussion instruments, drums of sorts, but because my ancestors aren't from there, I'm afraid I couldn't tell you.
Well, let's talk about some of the instruments that you know, you've unearthed doing your genealogy research on your own family.
Well, like I said, I'm one of these fortunate people. Yeah, everything is relative, being, you know, of course, but my family didn't know how to throw anything away, so it all got passed down to me. And my brother didn't care about those things. My brother loves music, but is never learned to play an instrument. And I don't understand that, but that's his issues, not mine. But when it came time for me to really want to play an instrument besides what my father had attempted, and this goes back to what you originally said, my father wanted me to play piano and sat me down and said, here's the book, here's the piano, let me show you what you're going to do, and this is what you're going to do, which was not what I wanted to do. So I do have that piano in my house now. I don't have any horrible memories of the torture of having to sit there and practice it, because my father gave up after probably about a month or two, but I was only five, you know. It was kind of early in my life to expect me to do that. Then when I was about 8 years old, I had been acquainted for all my life with my grandfather's instrument. He played what he called a Swedish or Norwegian harp. It changed nationality depending on what came out of his mouth at that moment. And what it really was a zither instrument. And the actual name is a harpalike. And I thought that it was the most fascinating thing I'd ever seen, and it was simple to play. And he taught me how to play that, so by the time I was about 8, I was playing that, but at my grandfather's house. He only lived a few blocks away. And one day my grandfather said, you obviously like this better than I do, so here, you take it. And all of a sudden I had this mammoth thing. It's about 3 foot by 3 foot. It's a pretty large instrument that was now mine. And my father taught me how to tune it, and I played that for a while. But I always wanted to play guitar, and after I had made myself a paper guitar and was pretending to play guitar, much like kids play air guitar or whatever that video game is.
Right. Or the blow-up ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's neat, right? A balloon guitar. This makes perfect sense. In fact, I saw some foam rubber guitars at the during Halloween time among the costumes. The kids could dress up like rock stars, I guess.
Yeah.
But my mother saw me with that, and she said, "Oh, you want to play guitar?" And I said, "I would do anything to play guitar." I was probably 11. And she said, "Well, let me take you upstairs into the attic. And here's where I give the admonition. Please, folks, do not ever put your instruments in the attic. Unless you happen to have a very well-insulated and temperature-controlled attic, that's not where instruments belong, nor they belong in the garage or in the basement. But anyway, that's where our instruments were." And my mother started pulling out all the instruments that had been in her family, and that included a violin, a mandolin, a banjo, and then what she had played when she was a kid was the ukulele. And so she handed me the ukulele and said, "Maybe you'd like to play this." And, I kind of looked around. I said, "Okay, none of these are a guitar." I was pretty smart. I knew what they weren't. And she said, "Well, if you learn how to play one of these, then we'll get you a guitar." Well, I knew right off the violin was out, because the whole idea was to sing while I was playing, and I knew that wouldn't happen with a violin.
No.
And the banjo looked really cool, but the ukulele looked most like a guitar. So that's the one I selected. We fixed it up for me, and I played that for about two and a half years. And while my friends were getting guitars and playing guitars, I was playing the ukulele. So finally I told my parents, I said, "Okay, I followed the deal, I learned how to play it, I played it so well, you got me a new one, and now I'd really like to have the guitar, please."
But it didn't run in the family.
they told me. So they followed the promise, and indeed I got my guitar. And so people ask me how long I've been playing guitar. I count my ukulele years in there, because those were the ones that trained me to be
right.
a guitarist. But I did eventually get the banjo fixed up and play that, and I've had it reconditioned. It's a beautiful 1889 Fairbanks and Cole parlor banjo, it's which means it doesn't have a super long neck. It's one that I can play very comfortably.
Yeah.
And I've had the mandolin fixed up, but I only play that in one program I do, and then the rest of the time it's kept in loving arms so that it doesn't... it was my great-grandmother's. I don't want anything to happen to it. But I play another mandolin. So the only one that I didn't end up playing from that group was the violin, which we got fixed up, and one of the granddaughters ended up playing that. So they've all ended up getting put to good use, and I'm very glad that my family did not know how to throw them out.
You know, I think back, and I mean, I'm trying to remember if I don't believe we had any instruments in our family that except for this. We had this gorgeous rosewood square grand piano that I wanted so bad, and my father ended up getting rid of it without asking me, but he swore that I had to buy a new house to put it in, because the thing was huge.
Yeah.
It was just huge, and it was gorgeous. So, there was a time when I really resented the fact that I didn't have that that piano. Not that I mean, I think I went pretty much like you. I mean, I you know, learn piano, I guess, during my early years. I tried to play the flute during the band, and mm-hmm. I really wanted to play the trumpet, and my mother thought that I was going to get buck teeth or some crazy cockamamie idea, so I didn't end up learning how to play a horn, and I regret that. But I think when I was 15, I picked up guitar, and I've been playing guitar off and on pretty much these many, many, many years. And, you know, just recently, I guess 8 years ago, picked up the steel drums. And, you know, one of the things, Gene, that I've realized, and I've, you know, as I've grown and you know, picked up an instrument that's very foreign to most people and very different to play, is that once you really learn to play one instrument and you understand, you know, the whole chords and harmonies mm-hmm. and things like that, that, you know, picking up another instrument is not that difficult.
Well, at least there's not as much intimidation.
Right.
Certain instruments, of course, require different abilities, different muscle work. One of the reasons that I love my parlor banjo is that when I played long neck banjo for a while, and my muscles just did not like it, and it was very hard on me. If I played more than two songs in a row on it, my whole left arm was just aching from the angle I had to hold it. And,
right.
So there's that issue that comes into play, but the principles, rhythm, and well, if you read notes, I do read notes, but I try not to do it too often. that whole principle, that's music. Yeah. You know, so you're right. You can pick up another one. And for a long time, I had resisted that, and I said, well, I'm a guitarist. I'm not going to play anything else. And I really enjoyed the sound of mandolin, and I thought, you know, there's no reason why I can't just try it, see what happens. And I took to it right away. It's quite natural. The frets are a different length or different size, so I have to be cautious and aware of that. But, you know, once you start picking up the instrument and feeling it, you get to know what it is. Sort of like the bicycle. Once you ride it, you supposedly always remember how.
Right.
The
now,
body,
you know, when we go back,
memory,
and I mean, it's
know.
Unfortunate that our society, and I guess going back to probably our generation, because I have a feeling we're probably of the same generation, and those subsequent to ours, you know, we've had so much, you know, other mediums that occupy children's time, such as, you know, television and video games and those kinds of things. But, you know, back during the times of our ancestors, I mean, there was no television. I mean, maybe there was radio going back another generation, but even
sure.
prior to that, you know, music was pretty much, in some cases, you know, the whole entertainment of the family, and families would really get together and they would jam. I mean, you know, it's I can't imagine
true.
What those jam sessions were like. I mean, I didn't get to experience anything like that because we didn't have that kind of thing in our family. But, you know, I could just imagine, you know, if we went back into the late 1800s and families would get together and you know, everybody would bring a musical instrument and
well, they'd sing.
You know,
they'd get together and they'd sing. There were the old favorite songs, and everybody knew them, whether they were the church songs or they were Stephen Foster songs. They knew the songs, and they would get together, and even if nobody played an instrument, they'd sing together. Because and we don't often think this way, but the voice is an instrument, too.
Exactly. You know, we and this is what it, you know, really is so funny. I mean, I don't know. There was an off-Broadway play called Stomp.
No, and, I love Stomp.
You know, I mean, I did get an opportunity to go see it because as a percussionist, because steel drums are actually it's kind of an interesting instrument. It's part percussion.
Oh, I know. I love steel drums. Oh my gosh! First time I heard steel drums, I thought I have to have one. Uh-huh. I've resisted the temptation up to this point, but now after talking to you, I'm probably going to be back at that.
Well, it's definitely a different instrument. I play what they call double seconds, and the notes are spread out over two drums. But it's got a little bit more harmonic and mellow tones than do the single tenor pans, which are a little bit more fast piano sounding, where mine I can do a little bit of that, but it's also more, you know, broad-based sounds, and you know, it really is. It's a terrific sounding instrument.
Right.
And I got fascinated. I mean, probably I saw the first time I ever saw it played was down in Jamaica in the late 70s, and
mm-hmm.
at that time they had the pans were convex, so that the notes were the pan
right.
stuck up, and the notes were on the outside of the pan. Today they're convex.
Oh, really?
And it's you know, I mean, you talk about an instrument that has gone from you know, from in just a few short years, it's, you know, keeps changing dramatically. And what's also very interesting about it too, Gene, just FYI, is there are no two pans made by two penmen that are the same. And they put notes in different places. I actually bought a set of pans down in Trinidad that I thought were close enough to the pans that I had to use as a rehearsal set, because, you know, you talk about soreness, you know, trying to lug in two pans and two sets of stands all the time if I wanted to rehearse was getting
right.
a little old. So I decided I needed a second set for the house. But the notes were far enough away, and there was one note, it was an A, that was not in the right place. And practicing on that and then going out and doing a gig and trying to play it in my pans were just slightly different.
Yeah,
didn't work. So you know, so I had to go back and the pan man that made my pans, he doesn't make the pans the way he made my original set of pans. So I had to take pictures, measure things, and yeah, so he could create a second set of pans that were identical to my first set. So it's definitely a different instrument than most people are used to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, it's quite different from what people are used to.
But, you know, going back to, you know, the music and our ancestors, you know, you hear and you see, I guess, you know, the old-style country music that came from Appalachia and, you know, the type of instruments that are used there. You know, I mean, instruments and music really has transgressed over many, many centuries. Of course, you go back into classical music and, you know, it pretty much stays the same and is beautiful and, you know, as it always was over many, many, many generations. So, you know, Mozart, for example, you know, Einstein was actually, you know, a big fan of his. And, you know, it's amazing how some of these things just are legacies, you know, forever and, you know, no matter when you listen to it. And it probably has to do, and well, I know it has to do with the use of, you know, notes and chords and harmonies that are just pleasant to the ear.
Well, I think this of course, you certainly appreciate because of your approach to genealogy, is that these sounds, when we are creating them together, I mean, just like you can listen to the banjo and by itself, a lot of people hate the banjo sound because it's a raw sound, I guess would be a way to phrase it. But when you add a fiddle and a mandolin to it and maybe some guitar and maybe a little bass guitar or bass, upright bass or something, all of a sudden you've got a blend that changes each one of the instruments as it works together, synergy kind of approach to things. But also the musicians, they change too. And when you play together or sing together, you create a synergistic effect where people are joining together to produce this hopefully melodious sound. And it's a spiritual experience. You know, not every musician would call it that.
Right.
But I've been looking at it in this way just in the very recent months as I have gotten together with people from different walks of life and different circumstances. I have a group of people that I hang out with. I'm the membership and meeting coordinator for our Riverside County Folk Song Society, which has been in existence for almost 50 years. And we get together and we play instruments and sing together in people's living rooms. And so this has always been something that I've been aware of. But this last September, I got to go back to Illinois to my high school reunion. And prior to the reunion, a bunch of us decided to get together and play some instruments. And this was not the whole high school by any stretch of the imagination. There were only about five or six of us there, and only four that were actually musicians. And we played and sang together, and it connected us. It connected us to the past because we had a tendency to play the songs from back when we were in high school, back in the late 60s. And we were connected to a time period. We were connected to each other. Now, none of us had communicated with each other before this last year except when we were in high school. So
right.
We had 40 years between communications, essentially, and we all connected on pretty much the same plane because we knew the songs and we blended them together, and it was a spiritual connection that just was put us on this high. You know, people talk about taking drugs to get high. I say, hey, I play instruments and I get high. But I
right.
get this sense of being on another plane and being away from all of the issues that plague us today, whatever it is, politics and war, healthcare, you name it. You play and you sing about other times and other eras, and you literally get transformed into another plane, and it's amazing.
It is. I mean,
you stop playing and you're right back to real reality. But
you know, when I play,
that's how people play all night long.
You know, which is less frequently, because I'm going to tell you, you know, you talk about being sore, setting up and tearing down after playing for 4 hours standing on your feet. And lugging stands and cases that weigh, you know, 20, 30, 40 pounds.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, reaching some of the ages that we reach, it's very, very exhausting. But I come home and I'm zoned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know any other way.
It does last for a while, doesn't it? Yeah.
To put it, but I'm totally zoned. I can't go to sleep. You know, on another planet. You know, I'm on a high. Usually, and you know, it's really. You know, it is. Playing music is a spiritual event for me. And, I mean, there's nothing more exciting, too, is, you know, when you go out to a jam and you just get a bunch of people together, like you say, and you just create on the fly. And, you know, everybody's kind of, you know, doing their own thing and digging deep, you know, for something to do that would make this thing sound even, you know, better. And,
right. Yeah, let's try just this way and adjust it, or let me try that with my mandolin instead of my guitar, and it changes it, but it maintains that sense of we're in this together.
It is, and you know, it's a shame that we don't do this in our families anymore, to the extent that they did many, many years ago.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned, you know, is that, you know, some of the musical instruments, you know, were really used as chaperones. People would come into the houses and they'd go into the parlor, and the boy and the girl would be sitting at the piano, and, you know, as long as the parents heard music.
Yep.
They
as long as the music's
everything
going,
was going
everything's
okay.
Safe. Yeah, once the music stops for any length of time, all of a sudden we have a parent in the doorway. wanting to know just what's going on now. And, music is a great chaperone. And I'm sure that there were quite a few young men and women that figured out ways of playing their instrument with just one hand. But I don't know that for a fact.
In any event, we will be taking your calls if you want to call in. The phone number is 888-815-9756. You know, if you have an instrument sitting up in that attic and want to ask Jean some questions about it, I'm sure she might be able to help you out a little bit.
You never know. I'm getting to know an awful lot of instruments. Let me clarify one thing, if I may. My doctorate is not in speech communication. My master's is in speech comm. My doctorate's in folklore.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, my doctorate's in folklore. So I have a background where I've done a lot of research of, and my dissertation was on family folklore. But because I've been a musician for so much of my life, I really did an awful lot of work in my doctoral program on various types of music. And, music, we also find, will be hallmarked at certain times in history. I'm particularly drawn to the music of the Civil War. There are just so many songs, and we still sing them from the Civil War period.
Like what?
A large quantity of Stephen Foster songs were either written or grew to popularity during the Civil War. My theory is that this is because people were getting pretty sick of the war, and Stephen Foster songs allowed you to escape from it. You could sing about Beautiful Dreamer and get away from thinking about the soldiers and all they were going through. But George Frederick Root, of course, made a name for himself during the Civil War and the songs that he wrote. So did Henry Work, who is probably best known for The Grandfather's Clock, but also wrote many, many, many war songs. And both of these men with songs like Tenting Tonight on the Old Campground or Vacant Chair or The Battle Hymn of the Republic, of course. So Julia Ward Howe wrote that. Think of the number of songs from the Civil War that we still sing. How about I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day? That's a Civil War song.
Okay.
And there are two verses that have been lost, not lost, but I mean, people know that they exist, but that nobody sings because they are specifically mentioning the Civil War, and nobody talks about them. And they actually tie the first part of the song to the last part of the song. And so when I heard the bells on Christmas Day, people don't realize generally that there are two verses that are left out, and they actually tie the whole song together very nicely. So there are events that we have in our lives that are hallmarked by music, and we can be brought back to those events through the music.
That's true. I know for a fact, too, that sometimes, I take some of these camping trips and stuff, and we'll do a campfire, and, mm-hmm. I'll bring out all the old campfire songs that I used to sing when I was at away at camp, and,
mm-hmm.
Good round silly songs, but that's what we did. And, it reminds me that we go back in time and we do some of these things that we did when we were younger, and we seem to draw the music, that is a reminder of those times. I didn't think about that, but of course. And, I remember, doing one a year ago, and, I probably spent a day on the internet going, trying to find all the lyrics to, half these songs that I, used to remember that we used to sing around the campfire.
You bet. Michael still rows his boat ashore.
Absolutely.
Even after all these years.
And Mariah.
Yes. Now, that's a show tune. And yet, it broke past the show tune genre and moved into the folk and even the popular fields, which is interesting to see how that can happen. It doesn't happen too often, but it does. Oklahoma. People, especially in Oklahoma, will be singing Oklahoma. That's a show tune. No, it's a Rodgers and Hammerstein tune.
Well, I play an Irish jig on the steel drums. Pretty funny.
Oh, that I have to hear sometime. That sounds great.
I love that. It is. It's you know, one of the things that I have learned, you know, since getting involved with an instrument that a lot of people have never even, you know, not only never right. seen, never heard, mm-hmm. But or never seen someone play, you know, is that you know, as I said at the opening of the show, I mean, music is a vibrational experience,
mm-hmm.
and it, you know, steel drums is not just for, you know, reggae and tropical music. I mean, you can play any music with it. Mm-hmm. You know, Andy Norell, pan player extraordinaire, plays jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awesome. And I had an opportunity to go hear him play when he was here in Houston. Absolutely phenomenal sound, solo performance in jazz on the steel drums.
Well, we need to not compartmentalize instruments as being specifically for a particular form of music.
That's correct.
The hammer dulcimer, which a lot of people think in terms of it being used for Irish music or Celtic music, has its origins in almost every culture. Almost every culture has a form of the hammer dulcimer. And I once heard a Asian player, I don't remember if he was Japanese or Chinese, and he played his cultural music on the hammer dulcimer. I'd never heard anything like that before, and yet it was the same instrument that I have a lot of friends that play it. I don't play it because I get very confused. It's tuned a little differently from what I my brain wants it to be, and so I don't play it. But I just had this perception of what kind of music I was going to hear, and boy, was I surprised! So, and a particular instrument, and of course the violin is a perfect example. I've known a few violinists who discovered, oh my goodness sakes, look, I can play bluegrass on this thing, and it doesn't even have the semblance of what many people believe the violin is supposed to be used for. You play it as a fiddle, and all of a sudden it's a new instrument, even though it's the same one.
Right.
So.
You know, it really is amazing. You know, I was just thinking back, I did a beach wedding not too long ago and played the wedding march, and I had so many compliments because nobody had ever heard the wedding march on a solo steel pan performance before.
Oh,
and it was,
my,
you know, kind of interesting.
Goodness. Yeah. That's great. I love it. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I mean, I had to learn it. That was no fun. That's not an easy song to learn, actually.
I wouldn't think so. No.
No.
No. But
it was.
But
it was terribly difficult, and you know, I set myself up so that I peaked at the performance. Because if you'd have heard me the night before, you'd have said, "You're not going to do this. You're really not
well,
going to do this."
Well, I've done a few of those where I've been practicing concertina, and my husband sort of leaned over and looked at me and said, "You aren't really planning on playing that on a stage now, are you?" So, well, as long as I can get just one song, we have a display we put up at some of the seminars and the family history expos of musical instruments that your ancestors may have played. And I told my husband, I said, "I'm not going to put an instrument up that I can't play. Now, I may only be able to play a half a song on it, but I've got to be able to demonstrate every one of them or they shouldn't be up there." So we've got about a dozen instruments up there, and people ask, well, could you play that? I said, yes, I can, and I'll play a half a song and say, isn't that cool? Put it away. So,
there was a film that I saw, and I was frantically looking for the name of it before the show, and it was not in my papers, but it was a film that was done on, you know, really kind of the spirit of music. And they took a song, and somebody in the United States started it, and they finished it in Africa. And, you know, it was cut together so that it was seamless. And everybody evidently just played the song all the way through. And then it was cut in such a way that it was one of the most phenomenal things I had ever seen. And it was the same song with the different sets of instruments, based on, I mean, it was like almost a worldwide tour of music just playing this one song. It was just, it was fascinating.
What an interesting idea. Oh, if you find out the title of that, or if somebody out there knows it, I'd love to get clued into that. That sounds
I will. Amazing. It was just an incredible experience to watch. And it really was. It just, you know, just really totally, I was in awe.
Yeah. But now we talk about about music and its effect on people, and of course that's a perfect example of how music can transcend cultures. But what about the Farm Aid concert?
Right.
You know, people got together, and what did they do to raise money? They sang. It just bothers me so much that music is being taken out of the schools because it's non-essential. And yet, almost everybody, and I can't say everybody because I just found somebody that doesn't like music, but it's because she's tone deaf, and when she hears music, it actually annoys her. But she's an exception. Most of us, if we just took the music out of our lives, we would recognize something was missing. A lot of people wouldn't know what it was. You know, if we stopped having music in the background on a movie when we're watching television, we stopped having any music accompanying video games, if we had stopped having music in the background in restaurants and every place else that it is, if we just took music out, people would know that there was something missing. It is essential. It's an essential part of our lives. Like you say, we have these rhythms, and that's part of our living rhythm. But yet they take it out of the schools.
Well, and you and I have had this discussion, too, about, you know, my subject of, you know, and your subject, obviously, of genealogy and connecting with self. And it's something that is not even taught in the schools about having kids do their own genealogy and learning about each other and learning about what was going on politically and socioeconomically in the days of our ancestors and where they lived geographically. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the learning experience that genealogy can bring to generations and tolerance and understanding, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. And the things that are probably the best things for kids today are not being done.
Well, when I was a kid and I learned history, well, I didn't learn history. That was my problem. I hated history.
Me too.
I'm probably the only genealogist I know of that hated history.
No, me too.
You did? Oh, I'm so glad that.
And I didn't know where any place was.
I didn't either. I could not. People would talk about Europe and the various countries. I had no clue. But the thing is that I had no way of relating to it. There was nothing that connected it to me and relevance to me. I had an added problem. I'm dyslexic, and so that added to the difficulty of reading and deciphering dates and connecting the dates to the right people. But because I didn't like history, of course, I did very poorly in it. And when I started researching genealogy, at first I resisted the whole idea of history. I was just looking at names, dates, and, hey, they're my ancestors. But then I started connecting to the events of history and how that impacted my family and how miraculous it is that I even exist when I think of how much they went through just to survive. And I have a whole new appreciation. Now, if that were taught in the schools, this is how it impacted your family. This is how it impacted you as an individual. I think that kids would do a whole lot better. You know? I think I may actually have had an interest in it if I had had an understanding. You know, I think my parents tried to the best of their ability, and my mother tried to do it through the music, you know, showing me the instruments and which ones had come from the old country and teaching me that this was part of my heritage, that my great-grandmother used to sneak into the family conservatory to listen to the concerts because they lived in Bohemia. And okay. I don't know who was actually performing at these concerts, but I have a feeling that they were some pretty big names in that conservatory. And she would sneak in and she'd sabotage the piano when people weren't around. So when my mother's telling me this, I started to appreciate, but then it never went as far as it could have. And I'm sad that now my parents are gone. I can't share with them my feelings about this at this point in my life. And more importantly, they can't share a little more with me because I probably zoned out after a while, you know, like kids tend to do when the parents prattle on. And I like all of us, doggone, I wish I could turn back the clock and talk more to Mom and Dad and Grandma and Grandpa about those things now.
But, well, you can.
You can. Yeah, this is it. So in a way, when I'm playing the instruments that belong to my great-grandmother and my great-granduncle, I have a sense of I'm touching them.
I'm sure you are.
I am connecting to them, and I pray that what I do when I perform my programs about musical some aspect of history, or I do one where I impersonate my great-grandmother and tell her story, and I play her mandolin, and I hope that she's happy with what I'm doing with it. I think that she probably is.
Oh, I'm sure she is.
So.
I'm sure she is. You know, it's, you know, in fact, I think some of this is, you know, probably coming from them. I don't know about you, but...
I believe that.
I mean, Einstein talks about it all the time, but, you know, I mean, we get intuitive senses or feelings or thoughts, and, you know, we wonder, where in the world did this come from? You know, where in the world did I, you know, learn how to play this? You know, I think that
but why did I hear that thing and know that was that connects to me?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you go someplace and you say, I know I've been here before, or I know that this has some connection to me. My son-in-law was talking about going to Watertown, New York. He lives in Atlanta, and he's always been a Southern boy. Now, he didn't know that his family actually had lived in Watertown, New York when this had happened to him, and he got off the bus when he arrived in Watertown, New York, and just had this overwhelming sense that he was home. And his wife, my daughter, and I were working on his family history, and doggone if we didn't track it right to Watertown, New York. And I told him, I said, you know something? I said, you and I might even be related, because that's where my family had its roots as well. And when I told him, I said, you're a Yankee. He was really shocked. He didn't like that at all, because he felt himself a complete Southern boy. And I said, no, I'm sorry to tell you, you are a Yankee. You go right to Watertown, New York, and I was able to track it right on down. And he said, man, that explains a lot. Yeah, because he's a very spiritual man. And he said, I really felt like I had just gotten home when I... That's in there. We have that imprinted in our psychic memory.
Yeah,
call it that.
So you know, I am living where my ancestors lived.
I mean,
I grew up in New Orleans. My parents were born in Chicago, and I moved to Houston. And when I started doing genealogy, my great great grandfather, you know, came to Galveston in the 1860s. And also in Houston, he was between the two. And, you know, I had no idea.
Wow.
None.
So you didn't know it before you moved there?
No.
You moved there and
had no clue.
Oh, wow.
There were any connections.
Now, when was the Galveston flood, the big flood?
It was 1900.
So were they
so,
there?
Yeah, I lost a great uncle. In the Galveston
hurricane. There's a great song about that, you know.
Excuse me?
A couple of songs, actually, about the Galveston flood.
Oh, really? Which ones are those?
I think it's actually two versions of the same song. Because when I listen to the words, there's some of the phrases that are the same, but it's called the Galveston Flood. And I'm been working at learning it. It's a really cool song. There's a history is being taught in music. And that's a perfect example of it, because I had never heard of it until I heard of the song.
Well, I haven't heard of it until you brought it up, and if you could send it to me, I'd love to see it.
Well, I have to find the words for you and send them to you.
I would love it. Because that would be something worth doing around here.
Yeah, they aren't singing it on the street corners there, huh?
No, not singing on the street corners of Galveston, not that I remember.
Oh, wow.
I've never seen it.
There's a mountain called El Picacho, and a friend of ours wrote a song about it, and another friend took that song to the park ranger at El Picacho and sang it for him, because he said, you got to hear this song, because it's about this location and about the events that happened there. So this song's about events that we don't even, a lot of times we get into the music of the song and the words of the song, and we forget that we're singing about actual events and actual people and actual impact on lives.
And too, that someone actually sat somewhere and drafted it. I mean, there's nothing to me more thrilling sometimes to go to. I go a lot to singer-songwriter events, and I love those because you get to hear the stories behind the music. And, you know, while you might have all the CDs and, their CDs in the world, you know, they don't tell the story. And it's a really cool thing to get to hear a singer-songwriter perform their music, but also talk about exactly what precipitated the writing of the song.
Right, the backstory. And so many of them have sometimes more fascinating backstories than the songs. And so I wrote a song about my dad and his experiences during Prohibition. And I have a friend of mine who has heard me sing it a few times and sings along on the chorus, but had never really listened to the words of the verses. And I was mentioning to him about my dad being, you know, in the middle of all this bootlegging going on. And he said, really? I didn't know that. And I said, well, you know the song, so what did you miss here? And he said, oh my gosh, that's what that song's about. So sometimes it really helps to hear the backstory.
You know, we were rehearsing with a friend, a vocalist, that was going to sit in with us a little bit, and one of the songs that we normally do, obviously, is Stir It Up.
Is what?
And Stir It Up. It's a Marley song.
Oh, okay.
And Bob Marley song. And she started to try to memorize the lyrics and said, I can't sing this. You know, it's really geared for a male vocalist. But what she ended up doing was taking kind of the song and the chord progression, and she actually wrote the cutest song that I ever heard. And I mean, I think it's going to go somewhere. It's really a phenomenal song. And it came only because, you know, she was trying to get a reggae beat and trying to do something within the lines of, you know, that particular song that, you know, she could sing. So, you know, it is interesting how things just kind of progress, and you never know where something's going to come from.
Go ahead.
That's okay.
One thing I want to make sure that gets mentioned here, too, is we're talking about history, we're talking about the identification with songs and all, but we also need to mention the emotions that get touched with a song. When we do our booth at the various places, people will look at some of the CDs I have there, and they'll just look at the titles of the CDs. I have one woman that almost burst into tears. She started to tear up. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, I haven't seen the name of the song for years. My father used to sing it. And just the name of the song, we didn't even sing the song. And she was touched by it because it brought back a memory, brought back a time period. And I think that the emotions that we touch with music awaken things inside of us. They awaken things that we'd forgotten about.
Right.
It's just a very important role that music has in our lives.
It does. And, you know, there are even, there are words in those in songs that clue us to things that we need to do or how we need to react or, you know, in solving a problem.
Right.
And it's amazing how sometimes you'll be sitting there with a particular issue that you're trying to resolve and you turn on the radio and, you know, there's the song that's telling you exactly what it is you need to be doing.
Right.
I mean, we all experience that. And
sure.
So, you know, there's that whole other side of what music does is that it can bring answers to, you know, situations that we're currently undergoing without us even knowing. And,
right.
You know, the other thing, and I think is that we're going back to the emotions. I mean, you know, how many times have we heard our friends say, you know, I want you to play this song because, you know, that song, it has, you know, we played at our wedding, or
right,
that was
that
the
was
first
our
song we danced to when we first met, or, you know, there is a lot of emotion that you know, drums, you know, comes from that. There are, you know, some holiday songs that make me cry because all I can do is remember parents and the holidays, and it just, makes me well up in tears.
I
go going to the mall sometimes, you know, during holiday season is
I start crying in the mall, right? I've had just the opposite.
It's a challenge.
I've had people say, "Please don't sing that song." That was the song that, you know, was playing when we broke up, or that was the song that when I hear that song, I'm reminded of this negative thing. So sometimes I've even had a person walk out when I started singing a song and then came to me afterwards and said, I couldn't listen to that, that brings up some really negative memories. Okay.
I have a friend that has a song called Daddies and Daughters that is probably the most beautiful song I ever heard. I cannot sit in the room when it's played.
Yeah.
And I have to literally walk out every time.
Oh.
I mean, it is, to me it's just... You know, a relationship that I had with my father, and, you know, I don't cry. I bawl. it's not like I can just sit there with tears just, you know, streaming down my eyes. It doesn't
People
do that.
People start moving away from you then, yeah.
It doesn't conjure up those kind of emotions. So I usually get my cue, and I usually walk out before it ever starts because I mean, I love the song. It's a beautiful song, and people request it all the time. It just hits me in a funny place.
Right.
And yeah. You know, it doesn't, you know, it's not a tearjerker. It's worse than that. So
yeah.
It really
well,
is.
Well, after my mother passed away, I couldn't play Will the Circle Be Unbroken for probably about a year. And that's one of my favorite songs, so that was really irritating to me that I would choke up partway through it. But this is not fair. Sometimes you just have to get past things and then bring the song back at the right time.
Yep.
And I've had people ask me when I play certain songs that are really tearjerker things where even stoic people will start to grab for the tissue box. How do you sing that without creating a reaction? One song like this, There Were Roses, which is a song about Ireland, the Catholic Protestant problems there. And I say, you know, the first few times I couldn't sing it. It took me a long time to be able to practice a song all the way through. But when you're performing, you end up having to step out of it and still sing it and yet not, you know, sing it with the feeling, but try to divorce yourself from what the words are saying and not concentrate on what the words are saying, or you end up there on stage bawling, which is so unprofessional.
Yeah, the only thing I can relate a story that we can end on a high note because it is...
Sure. Let's
you know, every performance is different. We were playing at an outdoor bar on the water where you're allowed to bring your pets.
Mm-hmm.
And this fella had brought his dog, and it was a lab. And it was, you know, he was sitting at the bar, and the lab was on a leash, you know, on the floor, you know, next to him. And we play our first song, which was a slow song. And the dog, at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the song, goes, "Oh!" So we play another song, which was a little bit more upbeat. And at the end of the song, the dog goes, "Woo, woo." Okay? Well, this went on the whole set. And every time we played a ballad, he would go, "Woo." And every time we played something upbeat, he just got very excited, and he would wait till the end of the song. I tell you, by the time, you know, the fourth song rolled around, then we could, you know, begin to see the pattern. I mean, we were laughing so hard. You know, we could hardly stand up. But, you know, it affects all
types God's creatures.
Of energy spirits. I mean, this dog loved music, and he loved upbeat, fast things, and he could not stand ballads. So,
Well, Bill Stain says all God's critters got a place in the choir, and that dog had a place in the choir.
Oh, it was one of the funniest gigs I think I've ever done. Gene, I really thank you for spending the hour. I think it's been delightful. I've had a lot of fun. You want to tell the audience how they can get a hold of you?
Sure. circlemending.org. And I do a blog, which is also Circle Mending, but that's circlemending.blogspot, I think it is. Let me look real quick.
Okay.
circlemending.blogspot.com. And but if you go to circlemending.org, you'll find a link to the blog. And happy to hear from people and their reactions. And I love collecting stories about music, instruments, and ancestry, and especially if people let me put them up on the blog and their family stories. I'd love to share them because, hey, you know, we're all in the choir.
There we are. I just loved it when I saw your title, Where Music and Ancestry Meet. And you're on Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect, so we're kind of on a safe way, same wavelength here, just
yeah.
A little bit different approach, I think. But it really has been a delight. In any event,
thank you very much.
I'm right. Susan King. You can reach me at www.susaneking.com. The show next week's going to be a mystery. Even for me. I do want to let everybody know that I have rebooked Summer McStravitt and Venus Andrecht in for December 15th. As you remember, we had to reschedule because of some overnight illness. But in any event, they'll be back on December 15th. So again, next week, a mystery. And thank you all for being here. Where Music and Ancestry Meet on Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect.